You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 325. And in this one, I chat with Jessica Serber. Jessica is a licensed marriage and family therapist, as well as the founder of Mindful CBT California. And in particular, we talk about her therapy story, being a sibling of someone with OCD, how she supported her sister, how Jessica brings mindfulness into the therapy room, working with mindfulness sticking points. She shares an ice cube exercise for learning to tolerate discomfort and uncertainty. We discuss self-compassion, self-punishment, an exercise for self-compassion, and much more. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you to Jessica for sharing her knowledge. And of course, thank you to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Jessica. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. And of course, we met in person. I mean, I was familiar with you because of Instagram before that, but we met in February at the Game Changers retreat. So it was nice to meet you and obviously get this recording in place. So it'd be good to just hear, you know, your therapy story. So what got you into being a therapist?
Yeah, so it was great to meet you in Denver at the Game Changers retreat. But what got me into being a therapist, it's kind of, you know, a little bit of a long journey. But before I actually went to grad school to be a therapist, I was working for a nonprofit with helping inner city youth who had various disabilities transition from high school into the entry-level work world. And that just really solidified for me that I liked working one-on-one with individuals and kind of, you know, supporting them to get to the place they wanted to get to achieve their goals. And of course, in working with these youth, so much more was coming up in our work besides just job skills and interview skills. And we were talking about all the other things in life that were affecting them and getting in the way of these things or making it challenging. And that just solidified for me that I really liked working in that role with people where I could help them and be a support system and also sometimes a guide, you know, when other things would get cloudy for them. So I went back to grad school to be an MFT, did various traineeships and internships. And that's what got me into therapy, but what got me into focusing on OCD was seeing my sister go through her experience with OCD from onset through treatment. And it really solidified for me that I wanted to work with this diagnosis and these people because there's so much hope with the treatment.
Nice. Yeah, thank you. And as you said there, your sister has OCD and, you know, you've asked her permission to kind of talk about it and she said yes. Initially very broad. Anything you want to say about your sister's OCD that would be relevant for our conversation?
You know, I mean, just kind of what I said already in the sense that there's so much hope in the treatment because I saw her at a time when she was really, you know, suffering with her OCD and didn't even, you know, none of us knew really what it was or what was going on. She's significantly younger than me. So when I was in grad school, I sort of broke the cardinal rule when they tell you don't start diagnosing everyone in your life. And we had gone on a family vacation and I really saw this all playing out. Since I was older, you know, I didn't live with them at the time. So I didn't have that day-to-day insight of how severe it really was for her. And after that trip, you know, sort of brought up that this, I thought she had OCD, and helped her find an ERP therapist, and just that, you know, it changed her life. And it still shows up from time to time, right? Like, we all know it never fully goes away because we all deal with that anxiety, but just how she really got her life back from it and was able to do the things again that she wanted to do and loved to do. And that's really informed kind of my approach to treatment, of looking at people as an individual, you know, and not just treating their OCD, but treating them as a whole person.
Yeah. Excellent. And is that, so with your sister, did her therapist kind of take that approach, or was it very much working on the OCD and then she was left to kind of figure out the rest?
It's an interesting question.
I mean, I think I phrased it very badly, but insultingly, no. But yeah.
No, I get what you mean. You know, it's hard for me to say because I don't know everything they did. I know that it was an ERP. She worked with an ERP therapist. And so she did ERP. But yeah, I mean, you know, she worked on, I guess, exposures that were aimed at allowing her to kind of move towards the things that she wanted to do.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Good. So as the sister or sibling, obviously, you helped to find a therapist, which is a big thing, and you identified it, which is an even bigger thing. But what was it like when she was in therapy? Did you get involved in exposures? Did you how did you help? Or yeah, I guess what did it look like for you from your side of things? I guess.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you're bringing this up because this comes up so much with the family members of the individuals that I work with. There's such a fine line between supporting your loved one and either accommodating them or trying to be their therapist, right? Like it gets really tricky. So I'm sure there were times where I totally overstepped my boundaries as sister and went into therapist mode. But I really tried to remember that, you know, I could interfere with the work she was doing if I overstepped too much and tried to take on that role of, well, I still get to support, you know, it doesn't mean that I have no role in her treatment and recovery. That being the support system is probably the best thing that you can do for your loved one. You know, so when there were times where it was hard for her or she was overwhelmed, you know, being there, being the person she could call. And then obviously just sort of like anyone would do, you know, asking if there are ways that you can support and treating them like a person again, yeah. You know, not just like, oh, this is compulsion. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really tough. I've heard that on the podcast before of loved ones kind of saying, you know, this is just OCD, but in a way that isn't supportive, and it's more just snap out of it. And it's finding that balance between, yes, holding the boundaries of this is OCD, and you know, if you do that compulsion, it's not going to help, and blah 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 blah. But then also not forgetting that there's a human in there too, you know, and not missing out on that.
Right. And not just any human, right? Like in this case, my sister or someone's partner or parent, even or child, you know, so that they're used to coming to you in a certain way. And now all of a sudden, every time they come to you, we don't want to be dismissive and going, well, this is just your OCD. Let's move on from it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's hard to find that balance. But I guess just general advice for siblings. I have actually done an episode, which I'll link in the show notes, specifically about siblings. But I guess from your perspective, just any advice for siblings that may be listening on how they can support their loved one, their sibling with OCD.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think what support I always come back to kind of what support means is being there for someone, right? Showing up, being there with them as they're going through hard things, letting them know that you're there if they need anything. As a sibling, you don't have any responsibility in, you know, fixing anything for your loved one. And the reason you don't have any responsibility is because you can't, you don't have any control or power in that sense. No matter how much you try to do it for them, it's not going to work and it's not going to help them. So we can kind of unburden ourselves as siblings, you know, from getting them to recovery or getting them to not do their compulsion in this one situation, to just being their support system throughout it. There was another part to your question that I'm blanking on.
No, it was mainly support. I started to say other words and then I was like, support just felt probably the most accurate.
Oh, I remember there was one other thing I was thinking. That also as a sibling, you know, I think it's important to also acknowledge the ways that your sibling's OCD might be impacting you. And that can range, right? Maybe it really doesn't impact you very much or very little, all the way to, it can feel like it's sort of taking over the household or taking over the relationship. And so being really mindful of that and honoring your own experience, because, you know, OCD will try to take over and it's successful sometimes. So as a sibling or really any, you know, loved one, if the OCD is impacting you emotionally or in any other way, to make sure that you're getting your own support also, because that can be really challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because I work with only children and adolescents, or children and young people up to 25. And I noticed that a lot, not in every young person I see with OCD, but there's a lot of the times that their OCD latches onto the sibling. And, you know, the compulsions are around then the sibling need, you know, has to keep their door shut at certain times, or they can't walk past the young person with OCD's room, or their phones can't come into contact, or, you know, various things, rules, which is obviously limiting the life of the sibling. And sometimes there can be anger outbursts, and it's absolutely what you said, spot on. And it's also like, where possible, trying to keep in mind that this isn't personal. It's their amygdala in overdrive and they're just desperately craving for that comfort. And as a result, sometimes it leads to anger or rules. And yeah.
Absolutely. That's such a good point. And, you know, coming back to this idea that I was bringing up of sort of treating the person as a whole rather than just treating the diagnosis. And of course, this is going to be up to everyone's individual therapist, but sometimes bringing loved ones into sessions, bringing siblings into sessions can be extremely beneficial. And a lot of people don't want to be hurting their loved ones through their own mental health journey, right? And so sometimes seeing, well, okay, what are the specific ways this is challenging on my family members can be the motivation or the thing that makes them willing to work on certain things. So as long as it's done in a loving and collaborative way, which is why I always say bringing it into session can be so helpful, I think is extremely beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, agreed. So before we move on from siblings, is there anything else you wanted to say on that topic?
No, I think we covered it all.
Cool. All right, excellent. So, you know, you use a lot of mindfulness and self-compassion in your therapy alongside ERP. So I guess I initially wanted to focus on mindfulness first before self-compassion. So it's just a general question of how do you bring mindfulness into the mix with ERP Is it kind of separate? Do you try and merge them in some way? Just anything you wanted to say on that.
Yeah, mindfulness is such a central component in my own life and just sort of worldview at this point that I definitely think I merge them. With ERP being kind of the guiding principle, and I almost look at ERP as like the big bucket in which everything else, it holds everything else that we do in therapy. But mindfulness kind of comes into every part of the process. And I really look at mindfulness broadly as awareness and openness to the present moment. Mm-hmm. So I teach mindfulness skills, specific mindfulness skills in my work, but also just bring mindfulness in as a guide, during exposure, to help the clients that I work with sit with the feelings that they're having, allow the feelings or thoughts that they're having to come and then to pass. Really kind of taking this whole approach to not trying to control the things that are outside of our control, trying to ride the wave of those experiences that are outside of our control, and then focusing on what we can control.
Absolutely. And yeah, riding that wave of emotion or uncertainty as we're in exposure is crucial, because if we can ride it out without doing compulsions, our brain can learn, hopefully. Good point. So I guess another question that comes to my mind is around, what are some of the mistakes that you see people making around mindfulness? And mistakes feels quite harsh, and I don't mean it in that way, but, sticking points maybe that, yeah.
Right. I think that sometimes when mindfulness is thought of as something that's totally separate from everything else, it becomes a big obstacle. Yeah. So if it's treated as, okay, now I need to do my mindfulness, or now I need to use my mindfulness tool, then we run the risk of that kind of becoming a compulsion or becoming its own stressor. And well, I don't remember exactly how to use that tool. I don't remember exactly what Jessica said in session. So I think this is where realizing that mindfulness is more of the lens through which we see everything, it is a lot more helpful, because we don't get caught in those traps of trying to do mindfulness in order to reduce anxiety or reduce uncertainty.
Yeah.
The moment we do that, we know we're back doing compulsions.
Yeah. I agree. I've heard that from my clients before of, I did the mindfulness exercise you taught and it didn't work. And it's like, why, the feelings were still there. And I was like, well, that's not why we were doing it. We were doing it to make space for these uncomfortable things, not to get rid of them.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a tough one and I get it. So when I was in that place, I absolutely meditated to try and get rid of OCD, and not to make space for it, which is where I went wrong.
And you're definitely not alone in that experience, because I think so many of us, when we're first introduced to mindfulness, just equate it with meditation.
Yeah.
And meditation is an amazing tool and vehicle for learning what it means to be mindful and incorporating a more mindful sort of presence or view into your life. But as you get more grounded, I'm sure what's happened for you too is, as you get more grounded in those practices, then we just start to kind of bring the mindfulness concepts into how we relate to everything that we go through and everything that comes our way. Yeah. So I've found that to be tricky too, is sort of trying to discern which clients or who is actually going to kind of benefit from meditation in and of itself. As its own practice or as a vehicle for learning mindfulness, versus who is this going to become a compulsion for and maybe not helpful, because perfectionism or black and white thinking that's so prevalent in OCD is going to latch onto this and now turn this into its own thing to be anxious about.
Yeah, really good points. And I think what came to my mind then was some people may not, maybe asking the question now, especially if they haven't necessarily come across mindfulness or in this context of, why do I want to make space for these horrible thoughts and this uncomfortable feeling? I guess at least to clarify, and then you can add, is we want to make space because as soon as we start to push these away or reject them, we're going to get more of it. And we want to allow it and make space. And then by doing that, we're telling our brain there's nothing wrong with these thoughts, that, you know, they're okay to exist. Yes, they're a bit scary, but they're not truth or fact. They can exist if they need to. And then eventually they go on their own accord.
I agree wholeheartedly. And I always come back to, let's focus on what we can control, right? And we can't control thoughts and feelings that are naturally happening in our minds. That's just part of being human.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I come back to let's not try to get rid of or control those things, but actually, what do you want to be putting your effort and attention into? What is more important to you? Let's focus on you doing that and allowing whatever thoughts and feelings come while you're doing that to just come. They can be a little sidekick, is how I refer to it a lot of the time. You know, they can be there as your sidekick, but your attention is on the thing that's important to you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Really good point. Yeah. Like you say, it's about also making space that these things can exist. I don't have to like them, but they can exist. And then because I have that space now, I can engage in what I want to do. As opposed to if we're wrestling with them, trying to push them out, we don't have any capacity to engage in life or values or whatever.
Exactly. We don't want to put 100% of our really valuable attention and energy into these things that are the least valuable things in your life, potentially. Yeah.
Spot on. Good way to put it. And is there, I'm sure there's many, but is there like one or two mindfulness exercises that come to mind that you could talk about? I don't expect you to do them, but like just to talk about them. So for me, one I use a lot with clients is Russ Harris's Dropping Anchor from ACT. I quite like that. So yeah, there's any like along those lines you can share, whether it's again people to just focus on their breath or...
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you one that I do a lot specifically for working on tolerating discomfort and uncertainty. I don't know if you've seen this before, but I refer to it as the mindfulness ice exercise. I don't know if there's a more technical term for it. But what I'll do in session, and it was so great when we were in the office and I could do it together with my clients, maybe we'll be back there soon, but holding an ice cube in the palm of your hand and having a mindfulness experience basically with that ice cube. And I will guide the client in just checking in with what they're feeling, what thoughts are popping into their mind. A lot of times there's a little bit of, oh my gosh, it's so cold. How much longer is this hurting my hand? Okay, I get it. Can I put it down now? and really being able to bring in the idea of, well, can you just make some room? Like you were saying, can you make some space for that discomfort or for that pain to be there? Or even can you make some room for uncertainty to be there that you don't know how long I'm going to ask you to hold this for? And what's really amazing is that, of course, it gets easier the longer you go. And it's a real life example of resistance makes things harder and willingness makes things easier. And what's very interesting is a couple times I've had the experience where someone has really had a hard time just sort of surrendering to that feeling during the exercise. So the whole time they're like, I'm at a 9 out of 10 in pain and discomfort. I really want to drop it. And we get to the end. And once we get to the end, then they're willing to do it again. You know, it's sort of like once knowing. So that's what I would say is almost quote unquote, like the worst case scenario is that it's hard to sit with it the whole time. But then we see, oh, I survived that really hard thing. And I know I can survive it again, which, you know, is what we work on all the time in treating OCD.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's a good example of ERP doesn't, you don't have to habituate in session, you know, which is your anxiety going down, or in this case, you're accepting the uncomfortable feelings of the ice cube. The kind of what you're saying there is more like inhibitory learning. Maybe the uncomfort is there the entire time, but then you survive it and you're like, oh, I did it. Same with ERP. And then that's what drives you back, not the reduction in anxiety. It's that I survived.
Absolutely. And that's happened with the younger clients, kids that I work with a lot, is they're fighting it the whole time. And then every week after, they're coming and going, can we do the ice exercise? Because there's this sense of mastery now. I know that I can do something that's really hard. I know that I can survive it. And that feels good. You know, it feels good to know that we can do hard things.
Absolutely. I think there's going to be several thousand people after this episode going to their freezer and grabbing an ice cube, including myself. So yeah, no, thanks for that. That's really useful. So I want to go on to compassion, self-compassion more importantly. Again, very broad question, but how do you bring self-compassion in to the work of your clients?
Yeah. My very broad answer is I bring it in all the time. And from the very beginning, I bring it in through modeling compassion for them. So, you know, self-compassion is just the same compassion we would have for other people turned inward towards ourselves. So from the very beginning, I am modeling compassion at every moment, you know, and I'm sure you experience this with your clients a lot, that people are very self-critical at the beginning of OCD treatment, mm-hmm. in large part because they're aware that their thoughts are irrational and that the behavior they're engaging in is irrational. And so it's not uncommon for people to come in calling themselves really harsh names and saying unkind things about themselves because I should know better. This is so silly. And those are, of course, on like the nice end of the spectrum of harsh things we could be saying to ourselves. So from the very beginning, I'm really working on helping to reframe some of those thoughts. Of, you know, I understand why you may feel that way, but it's really not that silly because this is how your brain is tricking you. So that's from the very beginning. But then when I actually start teaching about self-compassion and how to incorporate self-compassion is different for everyone. But where I find it's the most important and the most tricky is when self-punishment is a really big compulsion. So self-punishment obviously comes up a lot with more of the what's referred to as like the taboo themes, or themes, basically any theme where the kind of core fear is that you feel like a bad person in some way. So then I will actually start teaching about self-compassion. And I'm glad you brought up mindfulness first, because obviously mindfulness is one of the important building blocks and components of a self-compassion practice. So work it throughout kind of the whole treatment though. And sometimes also, I should say, sometimes being self-compassionate is an ERP tool in and of itself.
Yeah.
Because if the compulsion is to self-punish, to be really hard on yourself or deprive yourself of the things that you need to be a happy, functional human, being self-compassionate instead is actually an act of resistance towards your OCD. You're standing up to your OCD. So sometimes self-compassion isn't just, it doesn't always feel good, actually. You know, sometimes it's something to relearn, and that's the hard thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, some clients really resist it for many reasons, whether they don't deserve it, feel they don't deserve it, or self-compassion is fluffy. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's, yeah, but yeah, I think, like I say to my clients, like it's self-compassion is brave. It's tough to be able to meet yourself in pain and support yourself. It's vulnerability to be able to do that. And that's strong. It's not weak.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, also in the sense of treating the whole person, not just the OCD, right? So when self-compassion, when self-punishment can really be a detriment is when sometimes, you know, people's OCD will make them feel like they don't deserve to eat regularly throughout the day, or they don't deserve to take care of themselves, or they don't deserve to go out with their friends because my friends don't really know who I am inside. They don't know I'm this bad person. You know, that's where I think self-compassion again can be a vehicle for ERP, right? That will go in, you know, we all know that eating regularly throughout the day, taking care of our hygiene, going out with our friends is our sort of basic self-care practices. We need to be taking care of those things in order to feel good and function well. And so, you know, using self-compassion to say, well, I'm going to allow myself to do these things. You know, I'm going to realize that my OCD is robbing me of these things, and I'm going to allow myself to do them, knowing that my OCD is probably going to come with me and barrage me with thoughts the whole time about how I don't deserve to be doing this, or how it doesn't matter anyways, because I'm still bad deep down.
Yeah. Yeah, really good point. And kind of on that, like, and you mentioned taboo themes and the shame that comes with, well, OCD generally, but the taboo themes especially. I guess, how do you work a lot with that? So when, you know, I've got so much shame around these ego-dystonic thoughts I'm having about my child or my loved one or random strangers or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, always starting with kind of the psychoeducation about what OCD is and how it works. Yeah. So, you know, at certain points in therapy, that might become reassurance if I have to keep repeating that. But always start with that. And I think this is where it comes back to, again, not to keep repeating myself, but comes back to treating the whole person, mm-hmm. right? Because if from the get-go we go, well, I can't tell you that your thoughts are just thoughts because that would be reassurance. I'm not really treating you like a human being, yeah. right? So I really work with my clients on, we're collaborating. We're a team to kind of work against your OCD and start to treat it. So always starting with that psychoeducation, it's really important for people to be grounded in an understanding of why we're asking them to do what they're doing.
Yeah.
And grounded in an understanding of just what it is that they're experiencing and why it feels the way it does. So always starting there and really getting someone's buy-in is really important to the process. And then of course, working on, you know, not challenging the thoughts per se that say you're a bad person or that you've thought these bad things, so you don't deserve happiness, but really just working on the behaviors. And also working with uncertainty in that, like, well, I'm going to take the risk of allowing myself to go out with my friends and have a fun night. And maybe I come home and I find out that I really am a bad person and I didn't deserve to do that. But let's just go live that experience anyway and test it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Absolutely. And similar to the ice cube or the mindfulness question I asked and you gave the ice cube answer, I know compassion, as you're saying, it very much, it's from the beginning and it's something you're modeling and showing, and it's very nuanced. But are there any specific sort of exercises you do to really drill in the teaching of self-compassion?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sometimes I'll say sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know, sometimes I teach it just as a broader way of relating to yourself. Mm. But one that I do really like, especially to use before you're going to go do a really challenging exposure, is I will work with my client to write a letter to, ultimately to themselves, but we start out writing it to someone else that they love. Okay. Imagining that the person they love the most, a child, a sibling, a best friend, is in the same situation, feeling the same feelings that they're having, and really taking it out of the OCD, right? That this is about, you're about to go do something that's really hard for you. It doesn't matter what it is. And what would you write in this letter to your friend? And I'll actually have them write it out often and write the friend or the loved one's name at the top. Like they'll write it to them. And then at the end, you can cross off their name and write your name and read it to yourself. And that's one, you know, that I understand people might think is a little fluffy or corny. But I think it's really powerful. And I've had people actually bring that letter with them to do the exposures, whether it's, you know, I'm in the doctor's office in the waiting room and I have this letter with me, or I'm at the airport about to get on the airplane and I have the letter with me, whatever the exposure is about to be, and be able to read that to yourself just subtly kind of brings you back to a more gentle approach and a more mindful way of sitting with what it is that you're going through.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's helping the person show up for themselves in that moment of perceive, you know, of crisis, what it feels like. Yeah, I don't think it's fluffy at all. I think it's a great exercise. And I think the fact that you're getting them to write it to someone else initially just remove so many blocks. Because I imagine if you say from the get-go, no, you're writing it to yourself, they'll struggle to write it. But as soon as you say write it for a friend, they probably have no problem.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really like that. I like that you've added it to the exposure or reading it just before the exposure. But I think just the act of doing it itself, even if we forget exposures, there's probably something very healing in that.
Absolutely. You're right. There's value in learning, you know, learning to be compassionate to yourself and relate to yourself in that way, just across the board. And that, you know, that's what I really love about all of these different skills we're talking about, whether it's ERP or mindfulness or self-compassion or something else, valued living, is that these skills treat a person's OCD, these therapies treat a person's OCD, but they are also life skills. They're all things that will help anyone live a better life in general. So I just love that it extends beyond OCD too, and that it's something that people can kind of carry in their toolkit to all areas of their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, spot on. Okay, so slight change. You could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Jessica. What do you tell her?
I really should have thought about this ahead of time. I've listened to some of your questions before. The 20-year-old Jessica. You know, it's so tempting to say I would pick up the phone and tell her to not be afraid. Like that is the normal, or maybe not normal, but the natural thing that wants to come out of my mouth. But knowing what I know now, I wouldn't tell her to not be afraid, right? So I guess I would say, put your fear down for a moment and pretend it's not there. What do you want to do? How do you want to live your life? What's important to you? Put those things in the driver's seat and bring the fear along, you know, as a passenger.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I like that. And you've got a billboard in Cali. What do you want written on that billboard?
This one, I gotta admit, I cheated a little. I did think about it ahead of time. I didn't remember the other one though. But you know, even in prepping, it was really hard for me to come up with something. But the thing I just came back to was that I would just write on it in big letters, I believe in you. That anyone driving past that, it's going to mean something different to them.
Yeah.
But I just think that that could be really powerful, you know, to see whatever it is that you're going through, whether it's you're going through something hard, like OCD, that you're trying to get out of, or you are working toward or striving for a big goal, it's important to have someone else that believes in you too, right? It's one thing to believe in ourselves, but sometimes that's really hard to find depending on what we're going through. And if I can say one other, if I could have two boards, the second billboard would be about making the rest of your life bigger. You know, make your life bigger, make the things that are important to you the biggest part of your life. And as a result, OCD will have less room to thrive. So I don't know how that one would be phrased on the billboard, but that's just sort of something that I feel like is a really guiding principle in how I work with my clients.
Yeah, I like that. Absolutely. So lastly, anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
Honestly, no. I feel like we talked about a lot.
We did. Nice. No, I really appreciate you. Obviously, well, thanks to your sister for allowing you to talk about her, but I appreciate you talking about her and being the sibling, and obviously self-compassion and mindfulness, two important areas.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. This was such a lovely experience. And as you know, something I was really wanting to do. So I appreciate you having me on.
Nice. My pleasure. Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.